This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening, you're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila Ganesan. Tonight, we're discussing the ongoing case against the Ruma Bonda founder for alleged abuse of a teenager with special needs. First, we discuss the case and what we know so far. Then, we look at the measures in place to protect children within the welfare system and what more needs to be done. Tell us, are you following this case? What are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is just coming up to 6:08, and right off the bat, I just want to say that this is a story that's been getting a lot of publicity, and I think for the fact that a lot of the details that have come out have been shocking to hear, very sad to hear about. So Bella, as the person is being referred to, is a 13-year-old teenager with Down syndrome who was allegedly abused by Siti Bainun Abdul Razali, who is founder of a welfare home called Ruma Bonda. So the case first came to public light last year when a friend of the founder posted evidence of Bella's injuries. The person, Zurianti Sudin, called an ambulance when she noticed Bella's poor condition when visiting the home last year, and then said Bella proceeded to confide in her about abuse that she had faced at the home. And then the case has gained more social media attention when one of Siti Bainun's lawyers, Hafiza Hassan, shared some case details on Twitter. So what we know so far is that the abuse allegedly took place between February and June 2021 at a condominium in Wang Samaju. And Siti Bainun has since been charged with two counts of neglect and abuse under Section 31(1)(a) of the Child Act of 2001. She has pleaded not guilty. Now, based on a cross-examination with the fifth prosecution witness, Yasmin Nahar Mahmood, who was another resident at Ruma Bonda, more details have emerged, and really this is where it gets really difficult to talk about and quite shocking. So, you know, Yasmin talked about how the abuse began when Bella accidentally pulled a curtain and dislodged it from a rod, and therefore, you know, Yasmin was instructed by Siti Bainun to strip the teenager naked, to restrain her. There's basically talk of, you know, her having hot water poured on her, being fed rotten food, chili paddy, a lot of physical abuse. So, you know, a lot to really digest and very difficult things to hear about. But I think the question that has basically come, you know, alongside all of this unfolding in the courts is the question of how this could happen in the first place. If this is a home for children, you know, within the welfare system, if there is what kind of oversight we have? How could this be allowed to happen? And more specifically, the fact that it is a child with disabilities, and therefore, what kind of protection does our system offer when children enter a system when they might need more care than the average child? So a lot of things to unpack, a lot of things to understand. We're first going to look at the case itself and what we know so far. And after that, we're going to expand the conversation into the welfare of children within the system and what more we need to do. We'd like to hear from you. Are you following this case and what are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:13. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila. And today we are discussing the Ruma Bonda case, which is currently ongoing. Let us know, are you following this? What are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is family lawyer Go Siu Lin. Siu Lin, good to have you back.
Hi, Sharmila. Thanks for having me on the show. Yes.
So the Ruma Bonda founder, Siti Bainun, is being charged with two counts of neglect and abuse under the Child Act of 2001. Could you help us understand what this covers?
So basically, the provision says that if any person having care of a child abuses, neglects, abandons, or exposes the child, or acts negligently in a manner to cause that child physical or emotional injury, then that person is guilty under the Child Act and will be convicted to a fine not more than 50,000 ringgit or a jail term for not more than 20 years or both. So it's quite a severe offence with penalties. Yes.
So she's pleaded not guilty. How does this shape the direction the trial will take?
So in this case, the state against the accused, the burden will fall on the prosecution to show a prima facie case. That means a case that the magistrate must be satisfied that there is evidence to point towards commission of this crime. And if the prima facie case is established, then the defense will be invited to put forward their defense. And that's when the witnesses or whatever, you know, will be called into court. Yeah.
So the teenager involved, who's been named Bella, has been diagnosed with Down syndrome. How will this factor into the charges?
Already, children are considered vulnerable targets or victims. So in this case, Bella, who has disabilities, a special needs condition, Down syndrome, requires even more protection and a strong deterrent message to be sent out to the public. You know, it's a policy situation. So in a case like this, particularly in a criminal trial, we need to also ask the court and the prosecution involved what kind of special measures or protections should be put in place if, you know, Bella is required to come to court as a witness, or will she be accorded for sexual crimes? You have something called a legal companion, you know, to accompany the child. But in this case, if this is an abuse case, will she be allowed to have a trusted adult who can understand her communication style and to give her that moral support? So all this needs to be put in place, as well as what we will also term as a pre-trial ground rules conference with the judge and the defense and the prosecution. What are the appropriate types of questioning that should be allowed? What kind of language, you know, child-appropriate language and language? And if the child, for instance, like in Bella's case, if she's able to understand Malay all well and good, if it was a child with a different language ability or even blind with sign language and all that, all these special measures need to be considered and, you know, put into place so that she is able, or whoever, the vulnerable witnesses are able to give the best possible quality evidence in their trial to support the cause of justice. Yeah.
So there have been claims that Siti Bainun involved other residents in Bella's abuse, including, for instance, forcing them to restrain her and inflict pain on her. How would this type of involvement impact them?
So it's actually a very complicated issue, because we need to also understand when they are carrying out these tasks, are they under the control and direction of the accused? You know, were they themselves victims? Or did they willingly do it, or were they doing it under threat of fear, coercion, physical violence against themselves? So they could either be a child in conflict with the law. That means they are also charged as perpetrators with the ability to commit crimes, because under the penal code, you know, children above 10 years old can have the mental intention to commit crimes. But if we look at the surrounding circumstances and see whether there are other considerations, like in this case, they may instead be called, you know, as prosecution witnesses, or they may feel that they were unwilling participants. So all these factors would need to be considered by the, you know, the prosecution and the court and all that. Yeah.
And if these statements are found to be true, could Siti Bainun face additional charges?
Yes, because then she is actually not protecting all these other children, right? Instead of nurturing them and, you know, helping them to be law-abiding citizens, what is happening now is that they are all complicit or made to participate in, you know, terrible crimes against another person, if that was indeed the case. So, I mean, the decision ultimately is the courts. Courts, after considering the evidence, it's just that what's coming out right now is really quite distressing. And I think, apart from that, I think JKM police, you know, there must be a more stringent monitoring system of childcare centres, you know, private centres. And it cannot just be left to, you know, ad hoc cases like this that suddenly explode in the media and then, you know, belatedly action is taken. So something very sad.
Now, one thing that's come up is that the Chief Defence Counsel essentially claimed that the fifth prosecution witness, Yasmin Naha Mahmood, had given 10 false testimonies at the Sessions Court. Could you help us understand this claim and how this might impact the case?
So I was just reading the article about this alleged false statement. So this is a process within the criminal justice system where you have a witness giving her or his story, which is called the examination in chief. Then the defense will then try to poke holes or to verify certain facts or to even challenge your credibility, i.e. the truthfulness of your statement. So the defense's line of questioning is to show that, I presume, that this witness is lying or not credible. And whether that is true or not, I think the evidence is not completed yet because I haven't read any reports about re-examination of that same witness by the prosecution. So I would say it's premature right now to actually say, you know, this person is telling lies or untruths, because it is a very normal part of the criminal justice process to say, oh, this is incorrect, or maybe your recollection could be inaccurate. It could be inaccurate, yes, but then you have the chance in re-examination to explain why you said a certain thing. Maybe you had written it down, you know, a certain way, or recollected it. You know, it could be an innocent explanation. So let's just wait and see what the re-examination reveals.
And in a larger sense, what are some of the other challenges with a case like this?
A very emotional case, and I think everybody likes to jump on the bandwagon, and it's attracting a lot of publicity. I wish that the publicity, when media or, you know, high profile people are covering the matter, that we actually be sensitive to the identity of the victim, because we see pictures of her splashed without, you know, pixelation, you know. So this actually really impinges into this child's right to privacy, and we should, I think, exercise discretion and restraint. Okay, we want to help this child, but sometimes when you become too gung-ho and react emotionally without just taking a step back to assess, and we hope that the criminal justice system really puts Bella in the center and not merely react. I think what is seen right now, okay, a bit, I may be a bit blunt, but there was a huge lack of response from the Ministry of Women. And only recently, when a member of royalty had come forward to offer a watching brief team, then we saw a lot of action. But we would have liked to see action last year. Yeah.
Celine, so what would you like to leave us with?
I think all children deserve the best possible protections. Mm-hmm. And I hope that the government really enhances the budget for the JKM and police so that they can better serve, you know, children in all vulnerable communities, and not, you know, just special needs, but also the migrant children, children in divorce and custody disputes. It is not just having the court, but we need the support and the soft skills aspect of it. We need the child therapists, we need the evaluators, we need speedy resolution, but speedy but quality resolution. Because and we need specialists, judges, registrars, prosecutors, and people who really have the passion to support children, and not just people who are placed there because it's just another job. So that is my wish for child rights in Malaysia.
Celine, thanks for speaking with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was family lawyer Goh Siew Lin weighing in on the case that is currently ongoing against the Rumah Bunda founder over alleged abuse of a teenager with Down syndrome who was under her care. We'd like to hear from you. Are you following this case? What are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be looking at the gaps in our welfare system, what more needs to be done to care for our children. And for that, we'll be joined by Sharmila Sekaran, co-chair of Voice of the Children. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:38. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila. And today we're focusing on the Rumah Bunda case, which is currently ongoing. And essentially, earlier we heard about the court proceedings themselves and tried to unpack what's going on there. Now we're going to look at the gaps within our welfare system that allowed something like this to happen in the first place, the sorts of measures that we have currently and what more needs to be done. We'd like to hear from you. Are you following this case? What are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Before moving on to our next guest, I wanted to read this message from Lee, which in many ways sets up what we're going to get into next. So Lee says, we really need a ministry for children. We don't need three special envoys. Well, Lee, I'll put aside that thought on the envoys, but this call for a ministry for children has been around for a while. And the fact that really there's so many issues that would sit under this, there's so many urgent issues in regards to our children and our treatment of them and gaps really in terms of protection for our children. And yes, I think issues like this once again renew those calls and show us how urgent it is for us to have measures in place that are concrete, that are specifically targeted towards protecting children in our country. Let us know. Are you following the Rumah Bunda case? What are your thoughts? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Sharmila Sekaran, co-chair of Voice of the Children. Sharmila, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, good evening.
It's a Sharmila situation, yes.
I can see that.
So to start us off, what did you feel when these allegations of abuse were made public?
You know, Sharmila, I mean, every single time we hear of a child being abused, a child being violated, and, you know, you just have a sense that we're really not doing enough. In this specific case, I had actually started hearing about it just before the news broke. And I have to say that you know, it just broke my heart to think that, you know, a child was being violated, and in this case, specifically a vulnerable child because of her disabilities. And there were so many times when you kind of can see now with the court case, different interventions could have happened at different times and they didn't happen. It just goes to show how much more we need to do, how much more attention we need to place on children. I heard what you just said earlier, just before I came on, you know, with someone suggesting that there needs to be a ministry for children. And, you know, this is something that Voice of the Children has been calling for more than 10 years. It is really something that we need to happen very, very fast. And we need the right kind of people in the ministry. Having a ministry, but a minister who's ineffective, like the current minister, you may as well not have a ministry, but we need a ministry. We need to take children seriously, and we need to take the different categories of children, children in vulnerable groups, vulnerable communities, and see what we can do, a lot more that can be done to protect these children. We're not doing enough for all children, especially these children.
How prevalent are incidences like these?
So, you know, unfortunately, statistics are really hard to come by in Malaysia. For some reason, our government fears to know the truth and to share the truth with all of us so that we can take action as society. But what we do know is that approximately 1 in 10 children has been or is being abused, whether physical, emotional, or sexual. We also do know that when, you know, we don't have the specific breakdown, but we do know that when we talk about
physical and emotional negligence of child neglect, that is more prevalent than perhaps other kinds of abuse and violations. For some reason, they tend to categorize emotional abuse separate from physical or any other kind of neglect of a child. But I think one of the things that we really have to also remember is that any kind of violation of a child or of a person, but in this case of a child, any kind of violation of a child, any kind of abuse of a child impacts that child in an emotional and psychological way, in fact, even more than the physical abuse. And again, very often when we talk about or when we hear of these cases where a child has been abused, very little is written or spoken about the impact, the psychological impact, the longer lasting impact on the mental health well-being of the child. A lot more attention, I suppose, because it's something we can see, touch, it's more tangible. A lot more attention and focus is placed on the physical state of the child, whether it's physical abuse or neglect. Negligible, actually, attention is paid on or attention is paid to the emotional and psychological impact that the abuse would have had on a child, more so in a child of vulnerable from a vulnerable community.
Now, in this particular case, you know, it involves a welfare home. What kind of oversight measures do we currently have in place when it comes to these homes and their treatment of children? Have they been effective?
Not at all. I think we're in a conundrum here. We do have the Child Act, which I think a lot of people know about, which has gone through a number of amendments. We also have a fairly older Child Care Centres Act, which governs child care centres. And really, that's about it. We have very, very little to cover situations where a child comes from a vulnerable group within a care setting, like Bella. But really, even when we look at the Child Care Centre Act, you know, the good thing is that we do have an act. The bad thing is that it has not been updated, and it really does not take into account the changing times and society of Malaysia, as well as the enforcement of ensuring that the Act is complied with. So technically, under the Act, any child care centre, whether it's home-based or institutional, needs to be registered. But we know time and time again, and we do come across many unregistered childcare centres, and invariably that happens. You know, we come across them when, you know, something happens. A child has been abused, or violated, even killed, murdered within the setting. And then, you know, we start jumping up and down. But really, there's very little effort being made to ensure that all childcare centres are registered and to enforce the registration, where if a centre is not registered, they need to be put on a pathway towards registration. We seem to have a very kind of black and white perspective on things generally, where you're either registered or we hit you with a hammer, you know, you're unregistered. But really, what I think we need to go down the path of encouraging people to comply, finding out what the impediments to complying is or are for the various homes, and trying to adapt and you know, make sure that they do fall within the Act, so that a lot more work can be done in terms of oversight, which is not happening. But really, in this case, from what we are seeing and hearing, it does appear that there was some level of oversight, but clearly not sufficient, and clearly not for a child like Bella.
Yes, and that's actually what I wanted to hone in on. So the alleged abuse here does involve a teenager with special needs. Do we have specific legislation when it comes to caring for persons with disabilities?
Well, we do have the Person with Disabilities Act, but, you know, that is really a very, very superficial act. It basically just about acknowledges that we do have persons with disabilities in our society, in our community, in our nation, and we need to make sure that they have the right to education and healthcare and, you know, things like that. But in terms of drilling down and ensuring what kind of care and like coming back to the Act, it actually covers the entire spectrum of person disabilities. It's an exceedingly short act considering that it's covering a spectrum. We have to recognize that when we talk about person with disabilities, we're not talking about a single homogeneous or composite group. We're talking about people with varying levels of disabilities, varying levels of need, varying levels of abilities or disabilities. And then, of course, the varying ages. So you've got very young children, you've got your older children, your teenagers, right up to adults with disabilities. And this act actually does not distinguish. It covers everyone and the entire spectrum of persons with disabilities. So it's unfortunately grossly inadequate. And in particular for care, residential care of persons with disabilities, all it says, I mean, there is a clause, and I forget which section it is. There is a section within the Act, but it just basically says that we need to provide for residential care. But to drill down and look at what kind of care and the kind of people that we need to care and whether they need to be to go through certain courses, they need to be, have certain qualifications or not, none of that is set out in the Act. And certainly more so, there is absolutely nothing for children with disabilities or young people. In this case, you know, Bella being a teenager, there's absolutely nothing specifically for them within the Act. Generally, one would put all children under the Child Act. But again, the Child Act does not have clear provisions on how to deal with and protect children in a situation where they are vulnerable and in need of care. We do have generally children care of need and protection. And there's the right to remove a child from a home if there is belief that the child is neglected within the home. But in terms of a situation like this, you know, unfortunately, our laws are inadequate. We don't have the right kind of laws and provisions to go out and protect a child like Bella. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we can utilize, you know, but it's not prescribed specifically.
We're speaking with Sharmila Sagarin of Voice of the Children about the alleged abuse of a special needs teenager named Bella. And we'll continue our conversation after this. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers, BFM 89.9.
It's 6:52. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila. And today we're discussing the Rumah Bonda case, which is currently ongoing. And more largely, this notion of protection for the children within our welfare system, what the gaps are and what needs to be done. And we're continuing our conversation with Sharmila Sagarin, co-chair of Voice of the Children. Sharmila, I wanted to pick up on exactly that, really. What are the main gaps that has allowed for the situation to escalate this way?
So very often we see that two things happen. One, there is a very obvious power dynamic. And from the evidence that's coming out from the Bella case, we can see this very clearly, because it does appear that the perpetrator had wanted or expected the child to react or behave in a particular way. She did not. And that caused a certain level of anger, aggression, and it escalated. And increasingly, when a person does not react, when there is that power dynamic, and it's more apparent with people who are vulnerable, from the vulnerable communities, when there is that kind of power dynamic and the person does not react the way we expect them to react, there is an escalation. And if it is not stopped at the start, so if someone does not say that is wrong or it cannot happen, and again, if we use the Bella you know, what's happened and what's the evidence that's come out as the example of this, we see that there are other people, other players or actors in the abuse of Bella. And no one of those actors said, no, I'm not going to do this. So, you know, someone gives a command, other people act, and Bella is the victim at the end of the day. So again, it comes back to the power dynamic. Very often what we do see really in terms of this kind of violence and abuse is there is always the building of some level of tension until it explodes. And very often it starts out being verbal. And we also see this with intimate partner violence. There's an explosion. It very often could start out verbal. When the person reacts in a particular way, either kind of clams up and digs their heels in or cowers, then it gives the perpetrator, the abuser, more power over them. And eventually it escalates into something that becomes physical. And then, of course, the intensity of the physical violence or abuse becomes more, it intensifies. So really what needs to happen in terms of closing the gap is to acknowledge and identify the vulnerable communities or vulnerable persons. And again, you know, we must remember that people with disabilities, regardless of who they are or where they are, will always fall within the vulnerable community or vulnerable groups. And extra care or special care needs to be paid to them. People around need to be conscious and cognizant of the fact that just because a person has got a disability does not mean that they do not know or understand and do not have emotions about what is happening to them. Very often there is a perception that when someone who's vulnerable, basically they don't look very clever, narrates an incident that's happening to them, there's the tendency not to believe. And there's a tendency to believe a person who speaks well, dresses well, carries themselves well over a vulnerable person. So, you know, we need to break those perceptions, those mindsets to basically learn how to accept what a vulnerable person is saying, and then to uncover or take off the layers to then discover what really is happening. I mean, there may be a situation where when a vulnerable person may be actually talking about something else, something they saw on TV, they may not be able to articulate it, they articulate it as if it's happened to them, but there are ways of getting around it and to finding out what exactly is going on. Very often, like I said, we tend to kind of diminish or ignore what a vulnerable person says. And this happens also with very young children. They fall into the same kind of category or group.
We have just about a minute and a half left. What specific measures should we be looking at to safeguard vulnerable children in our welfare systems?
For a start, and this is right across the board, we need to take children seriously. We need to appreciate our responsibility to care for them and to protect them. We really need to enhance and you know, time and time again, when something like this happens, we talk about enhancing or uplifting the welfare department, giving them more resources, giving them more staff, ensuring that they do have the ability and the means to investigate, to monitor, to evaluate what's going on within the system of care for children, and to take measures, to take action. What happened to Bella did not need to happen. It did not have to happen for as long. She did not have to suffer abuse for as long as she suffered abuse. And that is something that everyone within the system, from the trustees of care homes and the people who run them, the board, right down to the welfare department and the workers within a home, everyone needs to be trained. We need sufficient staff, we need sufficiently trained staff and resources to ensure that we are able to take care of these children within the different settings. We need to think through and create far more legislation and deeper legislation, more thorough legislation to take care of vulnerable people and specifically children with disabilities.
Sharmila, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Sharmila Sagarin from Voice of the Children. Do weigh in. Are you following this case? Send your thoughts our way. This has been Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.